I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Latari Thompson, Support Services Manager and Spiritual Care Supervisor at Nathan Adelson Hospice. We all know how hard it is to lose a loved one, and the holiday season can be a difficult time for dealing with grief, no matter how much time has passed. Latari, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Heather.
So what exactly is Nathan Adelson Hospice?
Well, Nathan Adelson Hospice is the oldest, largest, and only nonprofit hospice in Southern Nevada. We provide comprehensive end-of-life care to our patients and families every day, working hard to fulfill our mission that no patient should end the journey of life alone, afraid, or in pain.
And what exactly is your job at Nathan Adelson Hospice?
So I am a chaplain by profession, but somehow or other, I got talked into serving as a manager of our support services, which means I supervise our chaplains, our social workers, and our bereavement care department here at Nathan Adelson. And I have the privilege of yet holding on to one or two patients that I'm still able to visit with and spend time with from time to time.
Yeah, that must be a really challenging position, knowing that all of your patients are there for end-of-life care.
It can be challenging, but Heather, it's also quite fulfilling to know that we are a part of their life at such a crucial and sacred time when they are preparing to transition from this life to whatever they believe is to come. Sometimes with my patients, I'll say they're transcending one experience to another. And that looks like different things for different people, but it can be challenging, but it can be very rewarding at the same time.
Yeah, that's an amazing outlook. Now, speaking of challenging, why is the holiday season in particular so challenging for so many people?
Well, loss is hard for everybody. You know, you lose someone that has been a big part of your life at any given time, and that, you know, that's grief is foreboding. But, you know, one of the big challenges of the grieving process is dealing with all of the firsts. You know, you have first birthdays without your loved one, or a first anniversary without your loved one, a first Mother's Day, a first Father's Day. And then, of course, there's the first holiday season. For some people, first or second holiday season. And the holiday season brings this awful awareness of the absence of the person you love so much. You know, you have traditions that you share together sometimes for 50, 60 years, whether it's, you know, how you're decorating the house or lighting trees or going Christmas shopping for the children and the grandchildren. And suddenly that person is no longer there for you to share those experiences with. And so that awareness is very foreboding and it's very heavy for some people. And it causes them to really be in a dark place at times.
Yeah. What's the best way to deal with grief, especially during the holidays?
That's a tough question. And it's tough because everyone grieves differently. And so there is no one size fits all answer to that question. Some things I might suggest is, you know, to be honest with yourself about what it is that you're feeling and what is your thinking, and be honest with others. You know, one of the things that as human beings, I think we like to, or some of us feel the need to avoid conversations about death and deny that death happens and even deny the feelings that we have of grief and sadness after someone that we loved has died, especially in the holiday seasons. And so a lot of times people aren't honest with one another about what they're feeling and they put on this fake smile. And I don't know how you feel about it, Heather, but for me, acting something other than I am is exhausting. And so it can be really trying for a person who is trying to put on as if everything is all right when it's not all right. So one thing I'd say is to be honest with yourself about where you are in your grieving process. Something else I would suggest is, you know, set boundaries. It's okay to say no. I have a bereavement group that I serve on Monday afternoons. And part of our conversation on yesterday was the ability to, you know, lay out the boundaries. If there's things that you don't want to do, maybe it's been a tradition you've had for a long, long time, but you're just not up to doing it this year. There's no obligation that you have to do it. Or if there's something new that you want to do, it's okay to change. There's no right or wrong way to grieve, and there's no right or wrong way for you to celebrate your holidays because it's completely new. It's completely different. The person you've loved that's been such a large part of your life for so long is no longer there. So everything is different. So you can go about it differently. And then I guess a third thing I would suggest is when you need support, reach out to somebody, reach out to a trusted friend, reach out to a counselor, a therapist, become a part of a grief or bereavement support group where you can freely express yourself and again, share honestly with others who are present with you and who are going through some of the same things and having the same feelings and experiences that you are having. And just finding that support and being heard goes a long, long way.
Yeah. Now, I agree that it's better to be honest than to try to put on a fake smile, but sometimes people do that because they find it difficult to have conversations with people without breaking down. You know, the emotions are right there on the surface. So, how can we communicate that we're having that type of difficulty to others so that they understand?
You have hit the nail on the head with that one. One of the ways is, again, and there's no one size fits all, but just to be honest, I'm having a really rough day today, and here's why. And when I say you hit the nail on the head, it is difficult for it to talk about it, but sometimes it's really hard for people to hear that. And again, because death is so taboo and grief is so taboo, and we like to put it off in a box where we don't have to see it, we don't have to deal with it, a lot of times it's hard for a person to hear or to be available for someone who is grieving. And so you have to know the person you can trust. You have, and if you don't have people around you that you can trust, find someone or some place. And Nathan Allison offers bereavement support, exceptional bereavement support in groups, both in person, which I think are very helpful for a lot of people, and for people that's not convenient or you know they're not able to get to the groups. We have virtual bereavement sessions that are offered a couple times each week. And we even have a limited amount of one-on-one counseling. I think it's important to find a safe space where you can freely express, because to internalize grief and to deny the things that you're feeling and the thoughts that you're having is very dangerous. And it can have many implications. It can have health implications. It can have psychological implications. It can just put you in a very bad place that's really hard to get out of if you're not freely communicating those things.
Yeah. So how would someone go about accessing some of those support groups and counseling services that you're talking about at Nathan Adelson Hospice?
They can call me. So they can visit us at nah.org and go into the tab that says bereavement services. And we have a current schedule of bereavement, both our in-person groups, our virtual groups. There's a number there where they can call or email us and tell us what it is that they would like to be a part of, and we'll get them signed up. And they can come right now at our Tenaya location, which is over at Mountain View Hospital. I am right now in the throes of our Getting Through the Holidays with Grief that meets on Monday afternoons at 3 o'clock. And we are hitting it head on because I think to prepare prior to it coming makes it a little bit easier. I wouldn't dare say it makes it easy, but it makes it a little bit easier when you've already kind of thought through and anticipated what kinds of things might happen. Because a lot of times people who don't give it that thought, they're surprised or caught off guard. You know, they're walking through the mall and they hear this song playing on the radio and they break down because that was my loved one's favorite song. Or they walk through Macy's and they go through the fragrance section or even the clothing section. And normally they would buy their loved ones a new cologne or a perfume or some clothing outfit. And they're triggered, they're reminded, hey, he's not here, she's not here for me to do this anymore. And so when we spend time thinking about those things in advance, it kind of prepares us and gets us ready. And it doesn't make it easy, but it may make it a little bit easier to deal with those things when they come.
Yeah. So what's the process or the criteria for being able to take part in these in-person and virtual support groups?
All we ask is that you come with an open mind and an open heart, ready to participate. There's no charge for it. It's free, open to the public for anyone who wants to come. And even if they don't call or sign up in advance, if they just show up, you know, again, they go to the website and they see where the different locations are. If they just walk in, that's fine as well. But no, there is no real criteria because at some level, everyone's grieving. And I've even had people to show up in the group who weren't necessarily grieving a death. Most people are grieving a death, a loved one, a spouse, a sibling, a parent, a child. But sometimes people are grieving other losses as well. And so anyone who's grieving is welcome to come and be a part of any one of the services that we offer.
Wow, that's fantastic. All right. So once again, that website is NAH.org. That stands for Nathan Adelson Hospice, NAH.org. If you click on the Bereavement Services tab, you can find out all about the in-person and virtual groups that are available at the various locations around the valley, NAH.org. And we've been speaking today with Latari Thompson. He's the Support Services Manager and Spiritual Care Supervisor at Nathan Adelson Hospice. And Latari, it's been so great talking to you, finding out more about how people can deal with grief, especially during the holiday season, which is so hard for so many people, and the resources that are available to help them through that process. So thank you so much for your time today.
It's been my pleasure, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Hello, I'm Kevin, President of the Dementia Society of America. Request our free guide. It includes information on brain health checkups and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Your brain will thank you.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Sam Mirajovsky, partner at Sam & Ash Injury Law. Teen driver safety is an important issue, and Sam & Ash Injury Law is hosting a teen safe driving essay contest with some pretty amazing prizes to encourage teen safety. Hey, Sam, thank you so much for being here today.
Heather, it's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
So, among all the law firms in the Valley, what's unique about Sam & Ash Injury Law?
Well, we're high energy, client-focused, community-focused people. Ashley and I are real humans. We both live here and work here in a beautiful valley. But we also, you know, we bring a lot of expertise with us. We've been both had long careers outside of Sam & Ash, and we got together and wanted to build a law firm centered around the client and not around the egos of the lawyer, not around, you know, some sort of image that everybody seems to be trying to have. We're just here to do quality legal work to help people get better and put their lives back together after suffering an injury. And then, of course, we want to make the community better. We want to make Las Vegas better. We love the city so much and are proud to call it home. So I think we're a different kind of firm and certainly the kind of firm that a lot of people have come to trust over the years.
Nice. Okay. Now, what inspired you to promote safe driving for teens?
Well, I have a teenage driver now at home, and I don't know if anybody out there listening, if they can relate to this. Every time that my teenager is out on the road, I am very worried. Now, he's a great driver. He's a safe driver, but still, he's a new driver. And there's a lot of bad driving here in town in Las Vegas. I can vouch for that, given my job. And I'll tell you, I think that for teens, one of the things that is really easy to do is you don't appreciate how quickly things can go bad out on the road. So distraction, cell phones, you know, emotions, things going on, teenagers are more likely to get into accidents and not necessarily even by their own fault, just because they're not paying attention, not appreciating the dangers of the road. So what we're trying to do here is get young people to think about safety and bringing it to their attention, the forefront of their minds, to keep themselves safer. And of course, to keep everybody else on the road safe as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I can totally relate myself. My son just turned 16 and he's going to be taking his driving test in just a few weeks, actually. So
oh,
this
boy.
Is very, very timely for me.
Yeah. It's scary. But and it's, by the way, it's great because they get this independence, right? And it's important. They can help you out, all that good stuff. It's been a great experience for us at home. I'm just saying, I'm a little scared for him when he's out there on the road and, you know, obviously praying for his safety.
Yeah, I totally get it. So tell me more about your Safe Teen Driving Essay Contest.
So it's really simple. It's a 400 to 500 word essay. You can submit it at samandashlaw.com/safe driving. And it's an essay where you tell us what safe driving means to you. Now, to qualify, you've got to be 16 to 22. So, you know, your son would qualify, provided that he's in a Clark County education program. And so 16 to 22, enrolled in a Clark County education program. And the prizes, there's going to be a few different winners here. You can go to all the details online. But basically, the top prize is a 2024 Volkswagen Jetta. So you can get a new car if you win the top prize here. And I obviously want to thank our friends over at Findlay Volkswagen. They're just incredible partners and do so much good in this community. So they've helped us put this together. And then we are offering also up to $5,000 in scholarships, a year's worth of free car washes in partnership with the WOW Car Wash folks, gift cards, and so much more. So there's some other prizes here too in play, and really hoping that we get some good submissions and we get young people thinking about what safe driving means to them.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. So what impact do you hope that this contest will have on young drivers?
Well, I hope that young people will think about this beyond just an abstract concept that you take in driving school and, you know, rules of the road and that kind of thing, that they're aware of. And I'm hoping, right, when you're putting together a paper, a quick, you know, it's not long, it's 400 or 500 words, but still doing a little bit of research, appreciating the dangers out there, thinking about the real life consequences of your actions behind the wheel, and hopefully build some better habits and reduce, you know, distractions and a culture of accountability. That's something that, you know, we learn as we get older, how, you know, you got to be accountable for your actions, and hopefully this gets young people thinking about it a lot sooner.
Yeah, for sure. Now, working in injury law, you probably see some sad scenarios. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you think teen drivers make?
I'm convinced the number one, and it's adults are guilty of it too, is the phone. You know, the phone is a distraction. A text comes through and you take your eyes off the road for a second and everything can change. Everything. Somebody can dart out in front of you. People here, you know this, people do not always respect crosswalks. People are running red lights. And you have to, even if somebody else is making a mistake, you have to be aware of what is going on around you all the time. You cannot be texting and driving. You just can't be doing it. And so many accidents here are preventable. And I can't stress that enough. The other one, of course, is alcohol. And, you know, a lot of kids go out and party and get caught up in that scene. It's so important to never drive intoxicated. Obviously, you shouldn't be drinking underage to begin with. But if you do, get a ride. Uber, don't get behind the wheel. Tragedy for everyone follows that decision. And it's really, at that point, it's not an accident. It's a crash. And it's something that you could have avoided.
Yeah, definitely. Now, how long is the essay contest open for entries?
Yeah, great question. Saturday, December 21st is when it closes. So still have plenty of time.
Yeah, nice. Okay, so you did give the website, but let's tell it again. Where can people go for more information or to enter the Teen Safe Driving Essay Contest?
Yeah, you can go to samandashlaw.com/safe-driving. samandashlaw.com/safe-driving.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, that website, samandashlaw.com/safe-driving. You can find out all the information there about the Safe Teen Driving Essay Contest. It's going from now until Saturday, December 21st. Plenty of fantastic prizes, including a 2024 Volkswagen Jetta, $5,000 scholarships, free car washes for a year, all kinds of amazing prizes that you can find out there. It's a 400 to 500 word essay for kids who are 16 to 22 years old in a Clark County education program. And once again, the website, samandashlaw.com/safe-driving. And we've been speaking today with Sam Marajofsky, partner at Sam and Ash Injury Law. And Sam, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about this fantastic Teen Safe Driving Essay Contest to promote safe driving among our teen drivers, not just your teen and my teen, but all the teens in the Valley. So thank you so much for your time today.
Heather, it's my pleasure. And thank you so much for helping us get the word out. It means a lot.
How was your drive to school?
Let me tell you, I had to get my iced coffee first. I just can't seem to put it down. My favorite rapper just announced a tour. My phone was buzzing like crazy. I'm so excited. I had to text all my friends right then to talk about it. Then someone started calling me and...
Let's try that again.
I turned my phone off right away. I never drive distracted.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Samantha Banerjee, Executive Director of Push for Empowered Pregnancy. The organization's Stillness is an Illness campaign explores the critical impact of potentially life-changing decisions during pregnancy. Samantha, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Heather, for having me and for helping us raise awareness of stillbirth.
So what exactly is PUSH for Empowered Pregnancy?
So PUSH is a national nonprofit. We are at this point entirely volunteer run, and we are founded by parents like me who lost a child to a potentially preventable stillbirth. So stillbirth is the death of a baby in the second half of pregnancy, and that baby needs to be born just like any other. And this is an issue which is very seldom talked about. And most of us who've been through this had no idea that it was happening to anyone in this day and age, let alone to us, let alone to, apparently, the CDC numbers show about 65 families every single day in the United States.
Wow, that's high.
It is. It's much higher than most people and even medical professionals realize. You know, the average obstetrician maybe sees like one or two of these a year. And so it feels like, oh, this is like terrible. It's just one of those things. There's nothing you can do about it. But if you take a step back and look at the big picture, stillbirth is actually claiming more children's lives per CDC data up to age 14 than prematurity, SIDS, car accidents, drowning, guns, fire, poison, flu, and listeria combined.
Wow. All right. Now, speaking of letting people know more about this issue, what's your Stillness is an Illness campaign?
So we're really excited to launch this campaign with our partners at Cobase. This is intended to, it's a three-part campaign, starting with general awareness, built around a new short film called PUSH. It's only about 7 minutes running time, and it walks you through, from the point of view of a family in the third trimester, you know, some critical decisions that both they and their providers are making, which will impact the outcome of their pregnancy. And our hope is that we can get as many people as possible to watch this and understand that if you notice stillness in your baby, you know, the movement's slowing down, the movement's getting weaker, or really any changes to fetal movement. It could even be a sudden kind of frantic feeling increase, burst of movement, that should be treated just like any other symptom of illness. So the same way if you had a sudden high fever, if you were suddenly very nauseous, like you would call your doctor and say, hey, this is going on. And they would say, oh, come right in. We want to check you out and make sure everything's okay. For some reason, that does not happen today when it comes to changes in fetal movement. And so that's what the campaign and the film center are on.
Nice. Okay. Now, how often are stillbirths preventable?
So there is research showing that very conservatively, we know at minimum 1 in 4 stillbirths in the United States are preventable today using, you know, the current tools and technology we have. And that includes 47% of stillbirths at term. That's at 37 weeks or later. For example, my daughter, who was born still 2 days before her due date. That said, there's still a lot more room for improvement. If we looked at our, you know, international counterparts, the U.S. actually ranks 48th out of 49 high-income countries in average rate of reduction of stillbirth over the past 20 years. And if we matched the rates of our best international peers, we would be preventing up to 75% of U.S. stillbirths. Literally, you know, tens of thousands of children every year that should be coming home from the hospital with their families and are not right now.
Yeah. Now, just to clarify, what's the difference between a stillbirth and a miscarriage?
The only difference is time. So a miscarriage is defined in the U.S. as any loss before 20 weeks, which is the halfway point of pregnancy. And a stillbirth is defined as 20 weeks all the way up through labor. And, you know, in terms of the grief, you know, it is very much the same. But from a physical standpoint, you know, stillbirths, because of the baby is big enough by that point that it still needs to be born, in most cases by a vaginal or a cesarean birth, there's a lot more physical trauma that happens to the mother's body. And so what we see is that moms who've had a stillbirth are almost 5 times as likely to suffer severe maternal complications that can potentially be life-threatening.
Oh, okay. Now, you mentioned some things that healthcare professionals could do to prevent more stillbirths, but what can pregnant women do to improve the chances of a healthy birth?
The main thing we always tell families is to know your normal. You know your baby and your body better than anyone. And so you should be on the lookout for, getting to know your baby's fetal movements. We always say movements matter. Know what times of day your baby's active, how long it typically takes them to, get to 10 kicks, what kind of stimuli they respond to. Because in many cases, fetal movement is the first or sometimes only warning sign that something is going on and that needs to be checked out. And so that's always the first thing is, know your normal. And if you have any concerns, whether about fetal movement or anything else, always ask and don't wait. So many of us carry regrets because we noticed something, and then we, saw misinformation online saying, oh, this is normal for babies to slow down at the end of pregnancy. That is not backed up by evidence and it's a widespread and dangerous myth. And so we waited until, we had an appointment the next day or, we had an appointment 2 days later, just didn't want to come in overnight because we thought we were being, overreacting. But what actually happened was we missed the window of opportunity when we might have been able to intervene. Not every stillbirth is preventable. I think that's important to recognize. Just like all of those other common childhood risks, like SIDS and car accidents and drowning, there are things that you can do to lower your risk, but sometimes accidents happen and, they can happen quickly. The difference, though, is that right now, no one is equipping parents with the knowledge or tools they need to know that they lowered those risks as much as they and their providers possibly could have. And so, we are walking around with a lot of excruciating what ifs. And so our goal as PUSH is to make sure that other parents are empowered with the information we wish somebody had given us so that we would know that we did everything in our power to prevent a tragedy. And the point of this campaign in its later phases is to make sure that our providers can say the same, because right now they are not getting the guidance and tools that they need to respond appropriately to concerns that parents bring to them. And that is the other critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Now, where can listeners go for more information about preventing stillbirths or to watch the Stillness is an Illness short film?
So you can find links to everything from our website, pushpregnancy.org. There we have our Empowered Pregnancy resources, which are always free and, link out to all of the evidence that they are based on. There's reminder tip cards for expectant families, that kind of thing. If you want to watch the film in particular, you can go directly to stillnessisanillness.com. And it's right there. You just click the watch film button and you can check it out. We encourage people to please share that with anybody you know who should watch it, especially those in the medical field. And we just, again, the number one takeaway is if you or anyone you know is pregnant and they are noticing they have any concerns, the response should always be, just go get it checked out. It's better to get checked out. We need to trust women's intuition. We need to trust that parents know their babies and their bodies best and that begins during pregnancy. And we need to empower them to speak up for themselves because unfortunately that is the reality of the system we live in. If you don't advocate for yourself, you won't get the care you deserve.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So once again, those websites, pushpregnancy.org is the main website for PUSH. pushpregnancy.org. You can find plenty of empowered pregnancy resources there, tip cards, all kinds of information about preventing stillbirths and having an empowered pregnancy. And then if you'd like to watch the short film, stillnessisanillness.com will take you straight there. stillnessisanillness.com, a very powerful 7-minute short film that's definitely worth taking a look at. stillnessisanillness.com. And we've been speaking today with Samantha Banerjee. She's the executive director of PUSH for Empowered Pregnancy. And Samantha, I really appreciate you being here and bringing to light this issue that, as you mentioned, not a lot of people talk about. I think not a lot of people know about. The numbers that you quoted were a surprise to me. So it's really great that you're out here raising awareness about this issue. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to be here with you.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is U.S. Army Soldier Specialist Christian Sutton, now known as the Bone Marrow Guy. November is National Marrow Awareness Month, and the soldier-led grassroots program, Operation Ring the Bell, is working to increase bone marrow donation registrations across the force. Specialist Sutton, thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
So what exactly is Operation Ring the Bell?
So Operation Ring the Bell is the name I give to what originally started as a hobby, has now become a Army-wide campaign to both register soldiers and kind of build the foundation for the Army to establish what will be the largest single source of bone marrow registrations in the United States.
What prompted you to start it and turn it from a hobby into a movement?
So to start it, I went to, about 2.5 years ago, I went to a punk rock concert. And I hate punk rock. I absolutely hate it. So instead of watching the show, I noticed this table in the corner that was registering people as bone marrow donors as they came in. And that really stuck out to me because it was about 10 feet away from a mosh pit. And something about that contrast of genuine humanitarian effort and complete chaos really just made me think this could work in the Army.
Okay.
So I reached out to that organization and got connected with Fleets of Life and started hosting drives around Fort Bliss, just wandering around into battalion offices saying, hey, I run the bone marrow program for Fort Bliss, which by default I did. I was the first one to do a drive in over 10 years on base. And it prompted us to kind of look wider. These drives just don't happen. About the Army registers about 800 people a year across the force. In 6 months of me just doing that, just wandering around with the only record being on my phone notepad app of doing these drives at different battalion formations, I registered 2,300.
Wow.
And I started to realize that the Army can do more and could easily do more. So I started helping people at other bases do drives and just wanted to get more word out, get more people registered. I started creating resources to help people do it easier and faster. And eventually I was able to convince my division CG, General Eisenhower, to implement what I believe to be the way for a division program to work. And that's where we kind of realized, like, oh, we can change the Army. We don't just have to do this and be the program. We can have this happen in an enduring fashion. We can just set up the foundation for the Army to take over.
Yeah, that's awesome. So why is bone marrow donation registration so important?
So if, let's say you get cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, or anything, and you go through chemotherapy, just for an example, it might damage your bone marrow's ability to reproduce itself. And the only way to recover that and survive is to find someone who has the exact same bone marrow as you, basically. And it's not like blood. It's more like organs. You have to find someone whose DNA is so close to yours that your body won't reject it. It won't even recognize it as another person's. And you can only do that by having this big, diverse, wide database of all different people and ethnicities and DNA types. And currently the U.S. just doesn't have that. Only about 6% of the population is on the national database. And that translates to a lot of groups having, everyone basically having on average, a coin toss chance of finding that donor that would save their life.
Wow. So what's involved in actually donating bone marrow?
I was like to ask, how do you think that you would donate bone marrow if you're going to? How do they get it out of you?
I'm imagining it's kind of like giving blood.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Like they stick a needle in and they draw it out.
I don't know if you already knew that or if that was just a good guess. But yeah, absolutely. Most people think it's a spinal tap. They think they're going to drill in your bones, break them. They think it's a painful, painful process. And it's always too painful when they say that. It's exactly what you just said. It's just like donating plasma. Nowadays, 90% of donations are done just like plasma. Two needles, two arms. They take bone marrow stem cells out of your blood, separate it, and put the blood back. And that is just a couple hours in a hospital bed watching Grey's Anatomy, and you've done the exact same process that everyone thinks is so painful. And it's not like blood. You're not just going to do it. You will only get asked to do that if you're directly going to save someone's specific life, because you're their only match.
Wow, okay. So that's what the registration is for, so they can identify those matches.
Yes. So when people register, they're not drawing blood for that. It's just a cheek swab. It takes like 6 minutes. We do them in motor pool or in the field. But you get added to the database, and sometime between when they register to when they potentially are matched, when they're 65, they might become a match to someone who needs their donation. And they'll get asked if they want to donate.
Nice. Okay. What response have you seen from the Army and also your fellow soldiers involved in Operation Ring the Bell?
For both in the short term for a single drive and over the last 2 years, confusion, I'd say. It's not often that a soldier goes to his Motor Pool Monday formation and suddenly he's getting a speech from some E4 saying, hey, he wants to donate bone marrow. But we give that brief, and we've been getting better about getting that brief and getting that information to the soldier and let them choose for themselves if they want to register. And the response has been pretty substantial. So the Army registers about 800 people a year on average for the last 30 years since the DoD program was established. We've registered 15,000 in 2 years.
That's great.
And the response of the wider Army is just all we've been doing is just championing this, saying, hey, we've found ways to do this better. We've developed ways to have the Army significantly increase the amount that they'll register. And they finally started listening. So the hope is that soon the Army will take what we've kind of laid down for them and implement it and become immediately take that number from 800 people a year to 100 to 200,000 people a year.
So the program has obviously expanded substantially since you started. What's next for you and Operation Ring the Bell?
I'm going to keep championing this. It's become my full-time job in the Army as a signal soldier to continue to push for this program and do these drives. We're working to establish programs at Fort Cavazos and Fort Campbell and on Fort Liberty and all these different bases to kind of build that foundation. So for us, in the short term, we're going to keep doing what we're doing. For the Army, the Army's working to start learning how they can take over this effort and really make a difference.
Nice. How can listeners get involved in helping out, even if they're not in the military?
Of course. So if people want to get on that national registry, the more people are on it, the better chances everyone has. If they're in the Department of Defense, they can go to salutetolife.org. If they're not, or on the civilian side, they can go to nmdp.org or Be the Match. And if they want to learn more about the Army, they can go to goarmy.com. If they want to learn more about me or this program, they could just Google Bone Marrow Guy.
Okay. All right. So once again, those websites, if you're in the Defense Department, go ahead and check out salutetolife.org, salutetolife.org. If you're a civilian, you can check out nmdp.org, National Marrow Donation Program, nmpd.org, or simply bethematch.org. bethematch.org. And if you'd like to find out more about Christian Sutton, who we've been speaking to today, just Google Bone Marrow Guy. It's easy. Bone Marrow Guy. And of course, we've been speaking today with U.S. Army Soldier Specialist Christian Sutton, who is known as the Bone Marrow Guy for taking on this initiative and growing it from nothing to an incredible program that only has the potential to keep growing. So, Specialist Sutton, I want to thank you so much for being here, sharing with us your passion, your movement, what inspired you, and how people can get involved and help out for National Marrow Awareness Month in November, but also on an ongoing basis. Sounds very simple and easy to do. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Cancer screening can save your life. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/get-screened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Maria Ross, speaker, empathy advocate, founder of Red Slice, and author of the new book, The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries. Maria, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So what inspired you to write your book, The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries?
I had written a previous book about empathy called The Empathy Edge that came out in 2019, and it was really the book that made the business case for the ROI of empathy and the fact that empathy could be a strategic advantage. It wasn't just good for society, it was great for business. And that came out pre-pandemic. And so I was delivering workshops and keynotes and talks to companies and organizations all over the world. And what I was finding was that some leaders were already on board with this idea of people-centered leadership, but they were struggling with some challenges around it, with burnout, with keeping performance standards high. And so I really wrote this book as a way to give those leaders a framework to balance both the needs of the business with the needs of their people while also taking care of their own mental health and not just snapping back to bossism, as I like to say, but still continuing to embrace empathetic leadership.
Yeah, okay. What are some of the common misconceptions about empathy?
Well, I think the problem with being an empathetic leader is there's a lot of false narratives out there around what it means. It doesn't mean crying on the floor in, you know, with your employees. It's not just about being nice. You can be nice, but not see someone else's perspective and take a next right step to move forward together. It's not about caving into unreasonable demands. You can still make really tough business decisions, but do that with empathy and compassion for the individuals that are impacted. And finally, it doesn't mean that you have to agree with someone. You can have an empathetic conversation to understand someone's point of view and their context and where they're coming from, but you don't have to walk away converted to one idea or the other. I like to say that empathy is about connection, not conversion.
Okay. Now, I think a lot of people associate empathy with emotions and emotions don't belong in the workplace, blah, 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 blah. So what are the biggest challenges that are associated with having empathy in our world, in our workplace, as you've described, but getting past that mental block of, no, this is about emotions, we got to keep it out?
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that so hilarious because we're dealing with human beings and you can't just park your humanity at the office door when you go to work. So whatever is happening for you in your life, in the world, economically, culturally, is actually going to, yes, impact your ability to do an accurate spreadsheet, for example. So we do have to bring emotions into the workplace because we're dealing with human beings. Now, we don't have to spend all our time there because we have work that needs to be done and results that have to be achieved. But I think that it's really important to understand that we're not, again, we're not talking about crying on the floor. We're just talking about being able to take a beat and understand someone else's perspective and leave the door open to maybe there's a different way to look at solving a problem or pursuing a certain strategy. That in and of itself is empathetic. And there's a lot of little things that managers and leaders can do in the organization that are empathetic other than having a really difficult conversation all up in our feelings. So, you know, things like empathetic benefits, for example, flexibility, wellness days, paid time off, extended mental health benefits, those are all perceived as empathetic benefits by employees. So we don't always have to be having like a difficult emotional conversation. And also understanding that empathy comes in two forms. There's cognitive empathy, where we use our head to imagine what something might be like for someone. But there's also emotional empathy or affective empathy, which is when we actually feel what they're feeling. But we use those tools to gather information about someone's context. So now we can act with compassion. Compassion is actually empathy in action. And like I said, that action doesn't have to mean changing your mind or caving in or agreeing. It could be just simply listening. It could be holding space. It could be making sure that you're prepared with the right answers to the questions somebody might have. So empathy doesn't always take the form of, you know, having a heart to heart with someone.
Yeah, that's a really powerful perspective shift there. Now, what are the 5 empathy pillars?
So these pillars are traits that I discovered across hundreds of empathetic yet effective and high-performing leaders that I interviewed, research that I compiled. These 5 pillars seem to be present within all of these leaders that seemingly effortlessly would be empathetic, but also very high-performing. And those are self-awareness, self-care, clarity, decisiveness, and joy. And so when you have those elements really shored up as a foundational basis for yourself, you're able to show empathy without, you know, losing accountability, without letting performance slip, without creating an environment of indecision, which is super unempathetic, right? When you delay decisions because you, quote, don't want to hurt someone's feelings, that's actually not empathetic. You need to be able to have a compassionate, honest conversation with someone who's underperforming, but not in a punitive way, in a way that says, like, help me understand what's going on for you so we can support you to do your best work. That's a very different tenor of a conversation than, you know, do this or you're getting fired.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are some strategies for strengthening those 5 empathy pillars?
Oh, there's so many, but we'll touch on a few high level. So with self-awareness, the obvious thing is to get curious and put your ego aside and invest in some time of self-reflection and self-assessment. You can take the Enneagram, you can take Myers-Briggs, you can take Clifton StrengthsFinder, but get curious about your own strengths, your own weaknesses, and especially important, your own emotional triggers, because you have to have your own house in order in order to be empathetic with someone else. If you are not grounded, if you are not aware of your emotional triggers, you have no space in your brain to take on someone else's perspective without defensiveness or fear. So self-awareness is the key. And then with self-care, you know, we're not talking manis and pedis here. We're talking about what recharges you and your brain so that you can show up at your cognitive best and, yes, at your emotional best and be able to deal with situations without anger, without frustration, without flying off the handle. And so you need to be self-aware to know what you need for self-care. Self-care is also knowing your boundaries. So are you clear with your boundaries? Do you know what recharges you? Is it something active or passive? And are you making time each day to engage in that activity and show a model to your team of how to take care of themselves so they don't burn out either? And then finally, just as a top level tip for clarity, you know, clarity is not just kind, as Brené Brown says, it also enables you to hold someone accountable because you can't hold someone accountable to an expectation you've never set. So the best empathetic leaders understand this and they help people understand what are the unwritten rules around here? What are the assumptions I'm making that we all understand what professionalism means or good communication or, you know, work ethic? Those are things that different people have different definitions of when they come into the workplace. And so are you articulating that and having a discussion with your team, not just about someone's job description, but about this is how we do business as a team. This is how we're going to operate. It's sort of our code of conduct, if you will.
Yeah. Wow. Some fantastic tips there. So where can people find out more or get a copy of your book, The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries?
Well, thank you so much. I hope they will check out TheEmpathyDilemma.com or any of their favorite booksellers. It's available everywhere. And, you know, when they go to TheEmpathyDilemma.com, they'll be on my website. They can check out my podcast. They can check out my speaking engagements and just also access some free resources.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, that website is TheEmpathyDilemma.com, TheEmpathyDilemma.com. The book is The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries. You can also find Maria's podcast. You can find plenty of free resources there, TheEmpathyDilemma.com. And of course, we've been speaking today with Maria Ross, speaker, empathy advocate, founder of Red Slice, and author. And Maria, great advice that you've given today and some amazing topics that you've opened up that need to be thought through. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me and amplifying this message.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Tony Farmer-Thompson, president of Strayer University. A new survey commissioned by Strategic Education found that almost 3/4 of U.S. workers say their employers provide them with opportunities for upskilling, and yet half of all employees in the country are worried about gaining the skills needed to advance their career. Dr. Farmer-Thompson, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Heather. I'm excited to be with you.
So what exactly is upskilling?
It's a great question. Upskilling refers to any educational programming that's designed to specifically help employees build their capabilities and competencies, ultimately minimizing the skill gap. And it helps employees advance in their career and within the industry and effectively helps the employee drive up their personal economic mobility. But what's important to note, Heather, is that with the technology and workplace practices evolving at such a rapid pace, it becomes very challenging for employees to continuously upskill to meet the workforce demands.
Yeah. So is that why so many employees are concerned about gaining new skills, even though their employers do offer educational opportunities? So it's mainly a time consideration?
It is, I think, really what the survey indicates is just a disconnect between the upskilling opportunities that are offered by employers and those that employees say they need. So I think it's simply one of communication and alignment between the employer and the employee.
Okay, so what types of skills do employees say that they need?
Great question. So in the survey, the employees said they feel they need technology skills to advance in their current job, followed by what we call hard skills and then communication skills. And the challenge, though, is the upskilling opportunities provided, as we talked about, are mainly in-house trainings. So these may or may not sufficiently address the needs that the employees have identified. And so when we think about it, we should really keep employees top of mind. And what comes to mind for me is the opportunity for tuition benefits. And that's where employers pay for a part or all of an employee's tuition. And this provides the highest level, Heather, of flexibility and autonomy for the employee. And it certainly is a way for employees to have the decision-making within their purview, where they want to study, how they want to study, and when they want to learn. And that's what's important to close that skills gap.
Okay. Now, a lot of employers do offer that kind of benefit, but if a tuition coverage or reimbursement program isn't already available at an employee's workplace, what's the best way to talk to an employer when someone's looking for more targeted upskilling opportunities?
Yes, it's important to talk to your employer first and foremost. So I say, go and talk to the employer about the skills the organization needs today. Like, what are they seeing as far as skills gaps? And are they having any indications of what the future holds? You take that information as an employee and you conduct your own research and determine what is the best way for you to obtain these skills. Is it a class, a certificate, a degree? How long will it take? What are the cost investments? All of those questions you want to research and answer for yourself. And then finally, go back to your employer and discuss ways that the organization can support you in developing your skills. And that's where the tuition assistance benefits becomes a great part of the conversation. You know, do they offer it for degree programs or stackable credentials? How is the organization willing to help you? And then finally, you must follow up and continually check in and say, hey, I've acquired these skills. And not only that, here's what I see as the benefit to the organization by doing so.
Now, even with tuition assistance or reimbursement, the cost of higher education can be a consideration for a lot of potential students, especially since with reimbursement, you would have to go through the program first. So what are some financing options beyond what an employer might offer that employees could tap into?
Oh, there are all kinds of options. And really, what we have to stay focused on here, Heather, is bridging the skills gap is so critical. More than anything, what we're seeing today are the implications for not doing so. And that's economic growth, productivity, and economic output. And so I've been in higher education for about 16 years. And in all of these years, I've always led the career services area. And prior to that, I started my career in human resources and in staffing. And so this disconnect must be addressed, and it can be addressed. And that is simply through communication and alignment between the employers and the employees. As the employers are investing in the training, they just need to make sure it is, in fact, the skills that the employees think they need. And so that's what's most important. And you can do that in so many ways.
Okay, awesome. So where can listeners go if they want to learn more about upskilling for better career opportunities?
Upskillingsurvey.com has lots of great tips and resources for employees.
Perfect. So upskillingsurvey.com is the website to go to. upskillingsurvey.com. You can see the results of the survey that we've been talking about today, as well as access plenty of more resources and information if you are looking to upskill in your current career, upskillingsurvey.com. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Toni Farmer Thompson. She's the president of Strayer University. And Dr. Farmer Thompson, thank you so much for bringing this issue to our awareness and letting people know more about, first of all, what the issue is, and secondly, what the solutions can be. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
Teachers are diverse, skilled leaders, innovating to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Teaching shapes lives. Are you ready? Explore teaching at teach.org, supported by the U.S. Department of Education and 1 million teachers of color.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, November 18th at 8 p.m., benefiting the Veterans Social Club. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And Miracle Flights is hosting the Wine Flights Holiday Wine Walk next Saturday, November 23rd from 5 to 8 p.m. with tasting stations at the 7 Lights for Flights displays throughout downtown Summerlin. Funds raised will help Miracle Flights fulfill their mission of providing free air transportation to kids who need assistance reaching medical care. Get your tickets or find out more at miracleflights.org. That's miracleflights.org.